It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
When we talk about child development, is sleep really about sleep? We're going to find out about that and more on today's episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're talking with Julie Mallon, who is a sleep consultant, podcaster, and public speaker. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
We're you know, always interested in learning new things about sleep, tips, tricks, science behind things, anything and everything that helps us improve our sleep or that of our family members. So tell us a little bit about your business. You work with children or toddlers or newborns of all ages. And how did you get into that work, and what type of work do you do specifically in that area?
So initially I started off, my first qualification was that of a midwife. And, you know, that's where I really became aware and discovered my desire to know so much more about the developing brain. And it's also about optimal health and how we can, right from the beginning, we can make a difference. So that was my first window into the physiology and the biology of children. I always knew I wanted to work with children. And then there was one particular night I was on the labor ward, and I delivered, because in the UK we deliver babies ourselves, and I delivered 8 babies by myself, and I just felt this was very unsafe. And how nothing happened to either the mother or the baby, to this day I'm not quite sure. But then when I came home to my own 3 daughters, I just felt I had nothing left for my children, which is not the mother I wanted to be. So I thought, okay, I need to think again. So I went back to university and I studied to be a health visitor. A health visitor, 4 main components are child psychology, child development, sleep, and nutrition. Huh. Then when I moved to the Middle East, they didn't have a health visitor role, but all the parents were talking to me and asking me questions around sleep. Now, in order for me to be the best practitioner that I can be, I knew I needed to study as much as I could about sleep, so that, you know, I really could be as evidence-based as possible. So that's where I really went down this rabbit hole. And I just get so excited in informing my clients and my parents with real information and evidence around sleep. So that's, now I work, but behaviorally. Mm-hmm. So parent comes to me and it's a behavioral issue, then absolutely I will help the parent. Now, interestingly, 3 times in the last month, I've had a parent come to me and it's not behavioral, it's medical. And, you know, I've said to them, this is going beyond my scope of practice. So therefore, you need to go to the medical field, because that's not how I can't practice safely. But, I did identify that the first child, I had said that I thought she was anemic. And they went to an ENT specialist, they went to a neurologist, they went to a pulmonologist and a pediatrician. They all said there was nothing wrong. The mother came back to me and I said, no, I still don't feel this is behavioral. I would like you to go back to your pediatrician and ask for a blood test. And the blood test came back that this little girl was severely anemic.
Mm.
So, wow. Now, I had worked with this family before, which is why I knew them. And I knew with the first and second child. And that's when the mommy came back and said, Julie, there's something wrong. This was the older child. And when I listened and I said, no, this is not about sleep. This is something else. And it was. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just out of curiosity, what types of things did you notice that led you to believe that this was, you know, not about sleep and that the child was anemic?
So first of all, and that's the beauty of a child learning how to sleep independently. When something is wrong, when something is out of the ordinary, the sleep pattern changes. And with this little girl, she had been sleeping beautifully for the last 3 to 4 years, completely independently. And then over a period of 1 to 2 months, the sleep started to fall apart. She was waking up in the middle of the night. And then I was asking about her general behavior during the day. So she was very tired during the day, but the parents thought it was because of the poor sleep quality she was having at night. But, you know, and I was asking about dark circles under the eyes and was she quite pale? And of course, we live here in the Middle East. And so most of the children are out playing a lot, so she shouldn't be. So It was just, and then also when I asked this of the mother, could she possibly be anemic? The mother would say, that's really interesting because I've always suffered with anemia. So that gave the mother the confidence to go back and speak with the pediatrician. So it's about knowledge, really.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break and we will be right back on Sleep Science Today. Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right, welcome back on Sleep Science Today. We're talking about children and sleep and medical issues versus sleep issues. So there's a lot to uncover here. One of the things that you said is that you started off getting your training and working with patients or clients in the UK, and then you moved to the Middle East. What are some of the differences culturally that you found? Because you said that there wasn't much help at all in, I think you said you're in Dubai. Tell us a little bit more about just sort of the cultural differences related to sleep and children.
So, I mean, this is quite an opportune question in that at the minute we're in the middle of Ramadan. So with that, that brings lots of cultural differences in terms of, you know, waking early and sleeping very, very late due to the cultural aspect. But as a society, that is one of the differences, that the evenings are considerably later. That's the main one. Is that it's a late society. It's changing. And, you know, people are becoming more aware of the importance of sleep. And therefore, you know, the parents, Emiratis or Kuwaitis, they're all wanting the best for their children. But culturally, and also, you know, quite often they live in big families. So you have the grandma and the grandpa. And of course, that brings with it, you know, opinions which aren't always of today. So that can pose quite a problem. And actually, it doesn't matter whether it's here in the Middle East or if it's back home in Europe. Parents will say, well, I just left you and you fell asleep. Why is it so different now? So I think we are in quite a different space in the world.
So, you know, so you talk about sort of extended families. And I'm thinking about newborns now and, you know, who it is that's helping with the newborn, how the sleep is being managed, the nighttime feedings and those types of things. Is there a difference that you saw culturally again between UK and what you're seeing in the Middle East in terms of who's actually working with the newborn?
The difference actually is there's a really positive uptake of breastfeeding. And I know in the UK, when I left the UK, the uptake of breastfeeding was as low as 2%. And breastfeeding is so important when it comes to the development of our children. Now, I also know that as a midwife, breastfeeding is, yes, of course, it's the most natural thing in the world, but it's also the hardest thing. And it requires a lot of support. And I do think that's why here in the Middle East, that the uptake is greater because we do have that support. Also, we have much greater access to breastfeeding support than you would back in the UK, where, you know, the UK... just from a finance perspective, you know, money is tight and the NHS isn't able to provide all these wonderful services that they used to. Whereas here, they are very readily available, very readily available.
Very interesting. So specifically what types of resources, if money were not an issue and we were able to give the best resources, what specifically would we be looking at?
The best resources would be that we work together as a community, in that it does take a village. And therefore, to have that family unit and to have a family supported. So the best resources would be to understand about the importance of sleep in pregnancy, not wait until a baby arrives. I actually had a call with a family today. Their little girl is 8 months old. Now, her perception of motherhood and parenthood was very different than the reality. So her perception was that she would have this baby, and babies just sleep and feed, don't they? And Now the reality is her baby is waking hourly, and she is really struggling. And that's because the child has only ever learnt to fall asleep at the breast, which is not sustainable. But there was no knowledge there prior to the baby being born. So I do think, in terms of resources, one of the best things that we could do would be to have that information prior to the birth.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So you know, you hit an area there where the parents maybe haven't had any reason to be educated about what to expect with a new child. And like you said, they kind of maybe expect that the child should sleep through the night. But when we talk about children sleeping through the night and cases that you've dealt with, is sleep actually about sleep? Or sometimes, like you even shared, sometimes there's medical issues in there.
I find that sleep is very rarely about sleep. And it's almost like it's a window into what's going on with our children. So in order to sleep, our children and their brain needs to feel safe. So very often, if a child is not sleeping, you know, I will say to the parent that they are acting out. So, you know, as toddlers and children, very rarely do they have the emotional literacy to explain to them what's going on inside. So very often they will say they've got tummy ache, or you know, they can't sleep, or they need to go to the toilet, or they want some water. That has nothing to do with sleep. That is absolutely what is going on internally. So sleep is, in its purest form, a learned behavior. Now, and I often say to my parents, excuse me, that sleep is like learning to drive a car. It's like learning to ride a bicycle, and it's like learning to swim. It's the same methodology. Our children need to learn how to sleep. You know, the mummy that I spoke to this morning with her 8-month-old, I was explaining how and why she's waking hourly. And it's because she's falling asleep on the breast. And when she wakes up, the breast is gone. Just like if I have a child who is falling asleep with mummy rocking her or daddy rocking her when they wake up, that however we've fallen asleep, that has not been, you know, it's gone. And so I will often say again that falling asleep, very often, if a child is falling asleep in a particular way, is the equivalent of the parent falling asleep in their bed. And when they wake up, they're on the kitchen floor. They couldn't possibly go back to sleep on the kitchen floor. They would have to come back to their bed. So that's why when a child is falling asleep at the beginning of the night, we need to set them up for any of these wake-ups, because nobody sleeps through the night. You know, right. With an adult sleep cycle is 90 minutes or thereabouts. Uh-huh. Our children's sleep cycle, pre-teenager or teenager, is approximately 1 hour. So that means, depending on how a child falls asleep at the beginning of the night, we are increasing 11 to 12 probabilities of them waking, because after every sleep cycle, they will wake up, check that they're safe. And if they are where they fell asleep, they can then connect to the next sleep cycle. But if they're not, then they have to go back to the beginning.
Right. Well, so then that begs the obvious question of, what is the most effective way to get the child to sleep so they don't have that shift once they wake up. But before you answer that, we've got to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back and we'll get the answer to that question and learn a lot more with Julie Mallon. So stay tuned.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right, welcome back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking about, in this case, newborns and children falling asleep. What would be the correct way or the most effective way to get your child to sleep so they don't have that shift when they wake up and find themselves in a different place?
There's many methods that a parent will practice to teach their child how to fall asleep. One of the most common methods, which I don't practice, is the Ferber method. And this is where, you know, a parent will place their child in their cot and then leave the room and come back at certain intervals, whether it's 3 minutes and 5 minutes, and they will continue to do that until the child falls asleep. Now, age plays a really important factor here. And there are certain times where you really would avoid that practice if you could. We need to look at our children's temperament, because if we have a really sensitive child, then doing something like the Ferber method, or it's often known as the cry it out, it's not the kindest to our children. Because, of course, our children don't know that you're going to come back in 3 minutes or 5 minutes. All they know is that you have left. And if it's before they are 8 months old, our children pre-8 months don't have what we call object permanence. So they don't know that when you leave the room, you're going to come back. So there's lots of factors that a parent would decide on what is going to be the best option for them. Now, the practice that I go through and encourage and teach my parents is a very... it's about collaboration, and it's something that we do with our children, not to our children. And it doesn't matter if a child is 6 months old or if a child is 16 even. Doesn't matter. It has to be collaboration. I love the quote by Benjamin Franklin where he says, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember, but involve me and I learn." Ah. So that is always the best, I feel, the best way to teach our children when we walk alongside them. So we're not fixing and we're not rescuing, but we are helping them learn how to fall asleep independently. And so again, with the method that I choose to teach my parents, a lot of psychology is brought into the sleep work, but we also need to look at the nutritional aspect. Are they having enough calories during the day? We need to look at the movement. So we mustn't think of sleep in isolation. And in terms of the best method, it has to be one that works for you as a family. With your method where you're taking it more gradually, where you start off very close beside your child, and then you gradually fade out a level of assistance, you know, according to all the neuroscience data, it takes 10 to 14 days to change the behavior of our child. And that's what we're changing. We're not changing our child, but we are changing the behavior. And that behavior could be that they may need to be rocked to sleep, or they may need to fall asleep on a bottle or the breath. That's the bit that we're changing. So you gradually fade that out over that period of 10 to 14 days. And by the end of that, the child should be, if we are consistent enough, the child should be falling asleep independently, then not being assisted. But we've also taught them something so fundamental and so much more distinct that they can do it. Mm-hmm. I would teach resilience here, because resilience is not born. Resilience is learned. In 2019, there was a really wonderful paper from the London School of Economics, and it was showing us that the one single rate-determining factor of success and happiness within us individuals is self-regulation. And that is actually learnt when we teach our children independent sleep.
So I'm just processing this. So when you're dealing with a newborn / toddler, so early in their life, and you're trying to implement what you were just describing, and if they don't have object permanence, how can you explain a little bit more about how that kind of works? Because how are they developing this behavioral understanding of this at that age?
Okay, so from birth to 12 weeks, approximately, newborns don't have any melatonin, that wonderful sleep hormone. That comes in around 12 weeks. But also, interestingly, at birth, our babies are born on a 25-hour clock. So babies arrive in this world with a 25-hour clock. And with the rhythm of our day and with the milk, with the feeding, that brings them onto a 24-hour clock. Now, at 3 months, approximately, they have the melatonin, but they don't have the capacity to learn to self-soothe. That they don't have.
Okay.
So in this period of time, what is very much what the child will be learning and which I will be guiding the parents is what we call sleep shaping. So we are helping the parent not create habits that are so difficult to fade out. So, for example, if a baby is only able to have a contact nap, then that's a red flag to say we need to work on fading out that contact nap so the baby can learn how to fall asleep in different sleep spaces. So in the bassinet, in the stroller, in the car. So that's where it comes into sleep shaping. Now, we also know, for example, that when our babies are first born, the brain weighs approximately 400 grams. By the age of one, the brain will weigh 1 kilo. So a huge amount of growth in that first year. Yeah. We also know in that first 3 months, the brain is growing 1 centimeter every day. So you can see there is so much change going on with this little person. And having a predictable routine is really helping our babies feel safe and secure. And that predictable routine can start as early as 6 weeks. So it's not that we have to wait until much later, but from as early as 6 weeks, we can have that gentle organic routine. So nothing, you know, rigid. That's at 3 months. Now, we also know, and all the parents out there who have had a baby who at the minute may be 6, 7, 8 months, 1 year, they will all know about this terrible sleep regression that happens at 4 months, the 4 month regression. But it's not a regression. And we know it's not a regression because around 4 months, that's when the brain expands and has the biggest growth than it does in the entire year. Now, what that means is that it's a progression, but it also means that the architecture of the sleep of our babies is really beginning to change. And some babies around 4 months have the capacity to learn how to self-soothe, but it is learning. Now, but it's not all babies. Now, at 5 months, we know that our babies connect with what we call the cingulate cortex. Now, that's telling us our babies really are beginning to learn and have the capacity to learn to self-soothe. But generally, most psychologists will agree somewhere between 4 and 6 months is a time where we really can teach our babies how not only to fall asleep independently, but to go back to sleep on wake. And when we teach them from 6 months, but that's where it is, that very gradual, we're staying close and we are teaching them a skill set. So the parent is staying beside them. And then over a period of 10 to 14 days, moving a little bit further away and a little bit further away and watching our children. So we're meeting our children where they're at.
Right.
So like, right. I've just started work with a little family, and this little boy is exactly 6 months old yesterday. Now, 1 week before we started the real sleep work last night, you know, I worked with a parent and we looked at how we were gradually going to reduce things in preparation for last night. So that when we started last night, there genuinely was hardly any tears from this little one. Mummy stayed beside him all the time. She soothed him with her voice. And then the little one fell asleep. And what happened there was last night was the very first time that this little boy only had one feed during the night. Prior to last night, this little boy had three feeds. Now, I know that these were behavioral wake-ups, not hunger wake-ups. And again, when we do the sleep work, it's never not to give our children food if they need it. Mm-hmm. But if it's a behavioral wake-up, then food is not appropriate.
And it was a behavioral wake-up because he was looking for mom?
It was a behavioral wake-up because they soothed him with her voice. And she put her hand on him, and then he went back to sleep. And then he stayed asleep. That was at 11 o'clock. And then he stayed until 3 o'clock. So can you see, if that was a hunger wake-up, he wouldn't have been able, A, to go back to sleep, and B, you wouldn't have been able to stay asleep that long.
Right, right. I see. Wow, very interesting. And yeah. And this is things it sounds like you learned through experience more so than from some sort of a course.
Yeah, it is. And it's very much about looking at our children. You know, we're relying on these monitors and we're relying on technology. Excuse me, sorry. You know, one of the things I say to my parent, behind every behavior is a communication. So look at your baby, look at your toddler. What are they trying to say to you? I've had a lovely connection with a family recently, and they have a little boy of almost three. And this little boy was really struggling with daddy doing the last part of the sleep work, which is to leave the room. And one of the things that daddy came up with was he made him a paper aeroplane. And for some reason, this really connected and really resonated with this little boy. So now this little boy fell asleep with his paper aeroplane. Now, as parents, we catastrophize. And suddenly, the parents were thinking, oh my goodness, you know, is his secure attachment now so fragile that he is wanting to rely on this paper plane? And so we had a conversation, and I was saying that, again, this was this little boy acting out. He was anchoring on this plane for now. And over a period of time, when he had time to process that he could allow daddy to walk out of the room, and also then during discussions during the day in relation to why don't we make a paper plane? And then 2 days ago, this little boy saw that the plane was all crumpled and he said, oh, it's okay, daddy, we can make a new one. So the little boy had shifted himself. So that's why we need to let our children take the lead sometimes. And like we said at the very beginning of our conversation, sleep is so much more than sleep.
Right, right. Well, this is a perfect spot for us to take our next commercial break. And when we come back, I'd like to kind of move up in age a little bit now, post-toddler and all the way into teen. So we'll be back on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job. She was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy. But every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movements and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking about sort of sleep through the ages here for infants, toddlers, children. So let's move forward to sort of children and even into teens. And so by a certain age, the child is typically in their own room in many cases, and they've learned some hopefully good sleep habits and behaviors. What types of problems and things do you typically see with a young child now?
Typically, say, for example, they go away on holiday, or the grandparents come, or, you know, they go through a cognitive leap. So, for example, what I do find is when there is a surge in language acquisition, I find that's a great disruptor of sleep. And that's because the brain is so active. There's so much neural activity going on during the night that it disrupts the sleep. So that would be a reason for sleep to be disrupted. When a sibling, I find, is the biggest disruptor of children. And very often, somewhere between 2 and 2.5, there is a spike in separation anxiety. And that's very often when a parent is bringing back a new baby into the house. And a parent will think it's because of the new baby that, you know, the sleep has completely fallen apart or we're really struggling, not understanding that actually it's a normal neurodevelopment part of our children. It's completely normal. And that's when we start to let those boundaries slip. We forget to be that loving leader that our child needs. Our children need us to be in charge, not in control. That's very different, but they do need us to be in charge because we know, again, according to all the psychology literature, pure attachment thrives when there is strong leadership.
So
that means something. What I also find is if a parent is having to travel a lot with work, that can often disrupt. And then, you know, when they're going up through different times of their schooling, friends, children having a hard time at school. You know, from birth to the age of 3, that's where the main framework of the brain's being built. And around the age of 3, there was a huge surge of imagination. And very often, that's where a child will start to be aware of, you know, of mortality. And they will questions. And again, I have been with a lovely family from 9 months and they're now four. And we often have, calls scheduled. And one of the calls recently with the twins of 4 years was exactly that. The twins were saying that they were asking about grandma and she's old. And does that mean she's going to die? And the father was saying, where did this come from? I don't know how do I answer? Or the other thing, which was very interesting, the twins were saying about everyone, all the mummies being pregnant. So of course, and the father was saying, where is this coming from, Julie? And again, I don't know how to answer it. But again, it's children. Children say what they're seeing. So they would probably be noticed that when the parents, the mothers were coming to pick the children up from school, they were pregnant. And it seems that there's just a lot at that time. So that's quite interesting.
Wow. So in terms of practical tips, you talk about the parents having this leadership role, and now you have, a toddler, maybe a new baby comes into the house. What are some things that the parents should think about? Because they're going to be having obviously a lot of focus on the newborn because there's just so much to do there. What should they be thinking about specifically related to the toddler now that this newborn is here?
One of the most important things, and it's not just toddlers, it's all ages, even teenagers, and the literature is there to back that up, routine. Okay. Children thrive on routine, and children love to know what comes next, and particularly a toddler, because a toddler, their desire for power and autonomy overrides their desire for sleeping. So yes, routine is one of the most powerful tools that a parent can have. So it's not about allowing all those limits and boundaries to shift, because when that happens, the children feel even unsafe. They feel out of control and they don't know what's going to happen next. So the most important thing is that we keep everything as safe and routine-like as possible. And then the other thing that we need to do when we, bring a new baby home, very often we try and continue the same old as when the child was an only child. That has gone forever. So one piece of advice here would be just to involve the child in all the activities together and stop doing too many separate things. Of course, we want to give some magic time to our child, but all it needs to be is 10 minutes. And I do, I describe it as those 10-minute magic moments. It's not led by anything other than what the child wants to do. That's it.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. So, excuse me. Are there any particular things where in all the work that you've done that you would say are most misunderstood issues about children and their sleep, the things that we haven't talked about potentially?
The first one is that parents think they'll just grow into it. They will just learn how to fall asleep. That absolutely doesn't happen. In all my 30 years of working with children, that does not happen. And how it manifests often with anxiety. So it's not that children will learn it. The eldest child that I've ever slept coached is 19. Oh. And of course, he is a child. His brain hasn't finished growing yet. The male brain doesn't finish growing till approximately 23 to 24 years of age. And with the female, it's 22 to 23 approximately. Uh-huh. So he was away at university and really, really struggling with sleep. He went to the university campus doctor who prescribed sleeping tablets. And that's for a 19, young, athletic, bright student. So his parents contacted me to see, is there any way I could do anything to help him? And again, it was all about upskilling him when it came to looking at his diet, not taking these energy drinks. That's a big factor.
Uh-huh.
Also looking at the screen time before he went to sleep and giving him different tools such as journaling actually for teenagers. And for males, we know that journaling is 30% more active for relieving anxiety and helping sleep, supporting sleep, than it is for females. So again, there's lots of tools that we can use when it comes to different ages.
Mm-hmm. And so was he able to get off of the sleeping pills?
He didn't even go on them, which was a really important, because the parent said, absolutely not. Now, interestingly, so he was away at university in London, and the choice that the parents had was, do we give up our life here and go back, well, go to London to support our son, because he is going to have to give up university, or does he give up university and come back here? That's not a choice. So that's where I came in, and we worked together. Again, that's absolutely where the collaboration comes in. And I used other things, like, for example, magnesium. I know there's a lot of controversy around magnesium, but the thing that is really hard to determine is, you know, if we are low in magnesium. It's a very, very specific test, which is hard. It's hardly available. Hardly available to most places. I know in America, for example, I think there's only 47 places in the whole of the states where we can accurately test magnesium deficiency. So, but for, you know, we got him to take some magnesium. And of course, the screen time was a big thing. And yes, his sleep, and he's doing really well at uni. And then what I also do is, coming up to exam time, like at Christmas now, just gone, I messaged him and said, just checking in, are you okay? Is there any anxiety around your sleep? Do you want a call? And he said, no, I'm absolutely fine, Julie. So yeah, very positive.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, that's, you know, such a common thing where either we individually go out and try and buy like over-the-counter supplements, pills, and things if we're having trouble sleeping, or we go to a doctor and we get a prescription, but nobody really focuses on the root cause, and that's really where the important work is done.
And do you know what his root cause was? He slept in the same bedroom as his brother. So he never fallen asleep by himself.
Wow.
And so when he went to London, he just didn't know how. And so it was really learning for the first time for many, many years. I mean, obviously he would have done, he would have done as a child then. But now it's completely different. So that's what I'm saying. We are growing an adult. We are not growing the child. And we want to give our children the tools to thrive and survive when we're not beside them.
Right. Well, we have actually come to the end of our time here. So this has been Julie Mallon. She's a sleep consultant, podcaster, and public speaker. Obviously very knowledgeable about sleep and through the ages, I'll call it, through infancy all the way through teen, we've had an opportunity to talk about. So Julie, any last words of advice for our audience before we have to go and end our show?
I think the last words of advice is, sleep is not a luxury. It's a biological necessity, and our children can learn. That's it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for the audience of those of you who joined us today on Sleep Science Today. Remember, you can always visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. You can get access to our YouTube channel and the podcasts and back issues of Sleep Science Today. And of course, new issues as they come out weekly. So we'll see you on our next episode of Sleep Science Today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.